Accession number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 12. Now, you left in, well, just after May, I presume, because that's when they went to the camp near Nicosia. When did you actually leave? Yeah. And where did you go to?
Yes, I left in September 57.
September, right.
Yeah. And I went back to the depot briefly. I had from 1950 to 50, I had 7 years, what I would call regimental service, and I was looking for something different. And I applied for two things. One was to become a helicopter pilot, and the other was to do a Serbo-Croat language course. I got turned down for the helicopter pilot bit. And I also was told I couldn't do a Serbo-Croat course because the vacancies were already filled. Would I like to do a Russian course? So I said, yes, I would, yes. And so I went home in September 57. I was taken on strength by the depot, and then I think probably the intelligence centre then took me on strength for a year's course at Cambridge University studying Russian, which began in October.
Now, what's the intelligence centre? Is that who?
The intelligence centre was a place called in Sussex called Maresfield. It was where, as it says, all training, intelligence training. It was the intelligence core depot at that stage, and also the centre for all intelligence training, which embraced the training of the teaching of languages, or at least the administration of the teaching. I didn't think at that stage it taught any languages, but it administered the teaching of languages. So
you were doing a one-year course at Cambridge University?
It was to be, the full course was 2 years, in fact, but the first year was at Cambridge University, Department of Slavonic Studies, which I found absolutely fascinating. A wonderful, wonderful year's course. I mean, it was added to, as far as I'm concerned, because the course started on October the 4th, and I got married on October the 12th, having met my wife in Cyprus before returning back to UK. So I did the year's course at Cambridge. It was my first introduction to really solid language study. It was night and day. I mean, in other words, it was daytime classes, lessons every day, all day, and lots of homework at night. We worked very hard for an academic year from October 57 to June, I suppose, June, July 58.
Now, was it all... Were you in a class with other students, were they all military?
RAF and Army. And there were 9 of us in my group, in fact, and there were also about 20 or 30 National Service private soldiers undergoing the same course. We never met them, really. They were separate from us, and we... the 9 of us just ploughed through the course for those. It was 9 months, an academic year.
Now, how did you take to that intensive academic effort?
Well, it was amazing because they taught us by what's known as the direct method. Not for 9 out of 10 lessons, not one word of English was spoken. We listened to instructors speaking in Russian. The 10th lesson was an Englishman teaching us the finer elements of Russian grammar. And it was only him could we ever ask anything about the language in English to get an English answer. And it was, as I say, the direct method. So for the first few weeks, we understood nothing. It was gibberish, absolute gibberish. And we had some brilliant instructors, some of them really old boys from yesteryear. Some of them recently absconded Russian majors, who'd thrown in the towel and escaped to the West one way or another. 2 or 3 of them via the Hungarian period of 56, in fact. And they just were very amusing. They knew that we weren't understanding a word, and they would keep on and articulate, and then they would articulate. No, they'd point at you, you know, and you knew they wanted you to say the same sounds. And by Christmas, we were beginning to understand more. The only thing that happened that helped us also was that every night we were given a couple of sheets of vocabulary with the English word and the Russian word. And the next morning they would go through every one of those Russian words and they would say, chai, coffee, сегодня, and they would give you the word and you would see, oh yes, today, tea, coffee, and then сегодня, you would practice. And so our knowledge built up. By the end of the year, we were beginning to be really quite competent. We could read texts. We could answer simple questions. So we thought we were doing quite well, and indeed we really were, because it's not a simple language, it's a very complex language. And then that finished. That was the end of the thing in Cambridge.
So that was to June.
I think it was about June, yes. I could
tell you. That would be about right.
Sent to the British military. Struck off strings, sent to the British military,
mission.
Thank you very much. Yes, I got BMD for some reason to France, and that was September 58. I went there, and I was posted to them in Paris, and I was sent to live with a Russian family. Now, by 90, the Russians who emigrated, who fled, if you like, from Russia to the West, in the immediate aftermath of the revolution in 1917-1918, almost universally went to Paris, because it had always been a strong French-Russian connection in the Tsarist period. The Russians spoke, nobility spoke French better than they spoke Russian. So they naturally tended to go and they established a major Russian community, still there to this day. But sadly, the sort of people who were likely to take in British army officers to teach them Russian were people who were needing the money and people who had probably become almost completely assimilated into French culture. And my lady, Madame Vasilyev, Madame Vasilieva, was married to a Frenchman. And the only person that really spoke very good Russian to me constantly was her mother, Olga Ivanovna, who only spoke Russian. And her sole topic of conversation was why had the slaves revolted, and so on. So it was great fun living in Paris for 6 months, but it was not very productive.
Did you leave your wife behind? Or
well, initially, yes, she was already pregnant with our first son, and she got fed up with hanging about and seeing me living it up in France. So quite understandably, I agreed with her. She came. I was not learning from this family at all. So she came over. She came over to join me in Paris, and our son was born in the British military hospital in Paris in October. No, November the 30th. November
so
the 30th.
So you've gone out in June.
I went a bit later than that.
July.
I suppose July, probably. Yeah. But it was not a good exercise, and I should say that we were the last year that the British Army or the British forces tried to find suitable Russian families for officers to stay with. It didn't work anymore. They were totally. Converted into French culture, really. So it was a waste of time. And I learned a bit, but not very much. The only thing I learned, not by living with them, but we did have lessons with educated Russian professors of different sorts. So I did history and Russian language. And that was quite valuable, Russian history. And that was quite valuable. I mean, to talk to somebody who'd actually stood on Red Square and listened to Lenin haranguing the population in 1917 was quite an experience, really. Anyway, the end of that period in France came in March, and I was March 59 now, I was posted up to Crail in Fifeshire in Scotland.
Crail,
C-R-A-I-L, to the Joint Services School for Languages, JSSL. And there, for how long, I can't recall, I think it was just a 6-7 month course of intensive military Russian. So by now, my Russian was not too bad. I did qualify as a, took the civil service exam and qualified as a Russian linguist at the end of all this.
Now, hang on, so you went to Crail when? Would that be March?
It was March, yes. I turned up there on the 4th of March, 59.
And again, studying Russian?
Military. Oh yes, military now. Military Russian. Applied, military applied Russian, if you like, yeah. Rockets, tanks, generals. Left flank, right flank.
So just military terminology.
Military language, military usage, yeah. Yep.
And what was the setup at the Joint Services School for Language?
Well, it was a former Fleet Air Arm airfield, and so we were in Hutted accommodation. They were all civilians. I think, the commandant was a military man. There was a military staff. The commandant was military. The lecturers were civilians. Again, I think they were mostly Russian, as I recall, who taught us this. And we lived up there in Crail.
Anything about the experience?
Not really. It was very good. It was very professionally done. We worked hard again.
So basically, the course is in three parts so far. And two have been successful, and one's been a waste of time.
The middle one was, well, in some respects, a waste of time.
Pleasant experience.
Correct, yes. It was not as effective as it should have been. As I said, that they ceased to do that the year after I did it.
So you qualified, while you were at Crail, did you take the examination?
Yep, I'm qualified as a Russian linguist, yeah.
And how did they test you?
Oh, I had to do written papers and an oral. The oral was fairly straightforward. It was asking me questions and asking me for explanations, fairly simple stuff. Because linguist is lower than interpretership, you know. I wasn't yet of the low quality and never became fluent enough to become an interpreter.
And this was
and a written translation from Russian to English and English to Russian and a composition, three papers, written papers. Rather like doing a school certificate again, really. And I passed.
And yeah. This was when did the course finish?
The course finished in June 59. It was just very short, that Crail bit. Just about 3.5 months.
So now you're a Russian linguist, what does that mean for you? I mean, are you still a captain?
I'm still a captain. I'm still an officer in the Suffolk Regiment. Not for much longer, by the way, because the wheels of change are grinding now. And what happened to me was that I was summoned to... There were two people on that Russian course that did better than I did. And might have hoped to get the job that I got, but they didn't for one reason or another. They were better at Russian, but not perhaps the most suitable. And anyway, the commandant at Crail called me in. It was amazing, really, how naive one can be. And he said, "Well, Captain Godfrey, you've done really quite well, and you've got your examination. Would you like to go to Berlin?" I said, "Well, yes, I think so, but what do you mean?" So, well, he said, "I'm going to recommend that you should be sent to Berlin to join the British Commanders-in-Chief mission to the Soviet forces in Germany." I said, "Yes, please, that sounds very good." He said, "Right, you'll be going in about September, so you've got a couple of months leave now. And you'll be hearing more about your posting. Well done, congratulations, where are you going?" So I went home to Charmin, and I said, "Look, we're going to Berlin, you know." Amazing, really. And I didn't know anything about, really, I vaguely knew about the British mission because I knew of the Russian equivalent.
Now, so you were going as a linguist?
I was going as
an officer,
General Staff Officer, Grade 3, with the ability to interpret. In fact, there were two qualified interpreters in the mission. I was not one of those, but I was required on occasion to go and interpret.
So you were a sort of fallback interpreter.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be the first choice.
But no, certainly not. No.
Now, tell me, what? Can you explain a bit more? I mean, we sort of glided past the Russian mission thing, but what is the British? So it's the British CNC's mission to Soviet forces in Germany. What does that mean?
Yeah.
What exactly was the nature of the unit?
I will tell you in where straight out. First of all, it's such a mouthful, that British Commander-in-Chief mission, that the telegraphic address was always used was BRIXMIS, British Exchange Mission, BRIXMIS. And the Soviet one to us was SOXMIS. So we always referred to each other as BRIXMIS, SOXMIS. In 1946, when just after the war had finished in Europe, and the Allies, which not just the Russians, British and American, but the French also, deployed on former German territories in accordance with agreements from Tehran and Yalta and then Potsdam, they all therefore filled in all the gaps and they found themselves face to face with each other, unable to say a word to each other. The Russian zone of occupation completely swallowed up Berlin, so because of the territory, Berlin being well to the east of Germany. So communication became a serious problem. If there was a dispute between the British, say, and the Russians for some reason, it went back to headquarters, British Army of the Rhine. It went back to the British, to the Ministry of Defence or Secretary of State for War. It went up to Parliament, to government. It went across to Moscow. It went back down to Berlin. So everybody agreed in the end in 1946 that this was absurd and that we really should establish missions to facilitate communications between the four allies on the ground in Germany. So the Russians exchanged a mission with the British and with the French and with the Americans. And we three Western allies did likewise with the Russians. Now, each national agreement was carried out individually. It wasn't a joint exercise from the West. And the British were clever enough to get the biggest mission. We had quite a big mission. It was twice as large as the French, if not more, and half as large again as the American mission. We had a lot of officers. We had, I think, a total of 25 passes to gain access to the Soviet zone of occupation, of which 9 were officers. And I think the Americans only had 5 officers, perhaps. I can't recall exactly. And our job.
What was the exact composition of the mission then?
It was commanded by a brigadier. The second in command was a group captain. There was then a GSO1, sort of senior staff officer, if you like, a squadron leader ops, a major interpreter, and a flight lieutenant interpreter. And grade 2 touring officer, major in other words, grade 3 touring officer, captain, just called touring officers, and 1 technical major and 1 technical squadron leader. So we had a big force of officers able to go on the ground. The reason the missions were formed was initially justification for them was communications, to simplify. Of course, it was a problem for the Western Allies wishing to gain access to Berlin, because Germany was divided into 4 zones of occupation, and Berlin was divided into 4 sectors. So we had to have the right to travel into Berlin, and there were what were known as air corridors from the Western zones of occupation into Berlin, and there were military trains from the 3 Western zones, and there were the use of specific motorways, autobahn, to gain access. And of course there were forever problems to be resolved over these means of communication. So that was the reason why everyone agreed that the missions were a good idea. Of course, everybody in the back of their mind thought, aha, if we get into the other lot, so whether you're Russian or whether you're American, British, or French, if you get into the other side, you'll be able to see what the hell they're doing, which was, of course, what everybody did, whether you were Russian in the Western zones or the three Western allies in the Russian zone.
So there was an unofficial espionage role.
Yes, there was. It was totally overt. We were not creeping around, with magnifying glasses in dark suits or anything. What our prime role was, really, and I mean, now one wouldn't want to talk about it until after 1991, but one can talk about it now. The prime role, in fact, was, or two prime roles. One was to confirm this is speaking from the British and the American and the French point of view, a huge amount of iffy information coming from more or less reliable agent sources in Germany, whether it be civilians, whether it be train drivers, lorry drivers, whatever, about what was going on in East Germany. We would be dispatched to clarify, what degree of accuracy that particular report and information. That was one, so we were confirmatory.
So how can you use an example of that?
Well, somebody would come over to the West and say, the Russians are building a new bridge which is quite capable of taking tanks at such and such a place. So we would get a report, we would receive a report from the JIB, Joint Intelligence Bureau in London, saying, would you check out what sort of bridge there is and get photographs of it, of the bridge at so and such a place.
Now, how would you do that? Because I thought you were restrained to corridors.
No, that was the normal movement of British, French and American military into and out of Berlin. No, the British and the American and the French mission headquarters were all in Potsdam, which is in the Soviet zone, just outside the territory of Berlin.
So you were allowed to drive where you liked?
We drove, well, within certain restrictions, yeah. We could drive around wherever we liked.
In marked vehicles.
We had...
Just as the Soviets were marked.
Yes, that's right. We had Union Jacks and number plates. And
so you would drive to the bridge?
Now, we would drive to the bridge, take a picture of it.
You were allowed to take pictures, were you?
Well, nobody...
Because in those days, cameras were more noticeable than they
are
now.
Yeah, we all had Leica cameras, yes. Big, heavy things. So you would have good ways of doing it. You would be circumspect about how you did it. But you would take... Yes, you would take a picture of it. And it might be that one of your... the technical officer would have come on that, because he is probably a sapper, a Royal Engineer officer, or a Remy officer maybe, who's skilled at being able to identify the quality of a bridge, for instance, the example I gave you. If it was a new barracks or a new training area being developed, then that's the thing that, again, we could report on.
Yeah. Would the Russians ever stop you and search you or take you in hands? Because you said when you were talking from the other side that if they saw the Soviets, you'd stop them.
Okay. And they would stop us. They would never enter our vehicles, because it was a sort of unwritten rule that, having said that, once or twice vehicles were broken into by people from either Russian or more likely East German Stasi people, really. But you were sacrosanct inside your vehicle with the doors locked.
But they'd stop you.
They could stop you. Only Russians could stop you. If the German army stopped, you would say, send me, I will not speak to you, send me a Russian officer. Or send me to a Russian officer.
So if you were near this bridge, they could stop you going any closer while pending the arrival of a Soviet. What would happen here? I presume you'd just give up. Would you try again? Or?
Yeah. He would say, what are you doing here? We'd say, well, we're just having our lunch, actually. whatever. He said, well, why are you in this area? Well, we have the right to move freely. It's not a restricted area. And he'd say, yes, it is. And I'd say, it isn't. We have permanently restricted areas. Your headquarters in Lossenwunstorf sends us maps. We have temporary restricted areas. If it is a temporary restricted area and it was issued today after 9 o'clock this morning, then I wouldn't know about it. And so you'd go on arguing like this. He said, well, you must come back to my headquarters. So you'd go back with him. So you always obeyed him.
You would always obey.
Oh, yeah, always.
Now, this, and from the other side, that's what they do when you've been told to intercept the Soviet one.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they do.
Yes. So in our case, I said to you, a military police people would be summoned to the Soviet vehicle. And he would protest furiously, the Soviet word, that he was being delayed.
Exactly as you did.
Exactly as we did, yeah. Yeah.
And you'd be just as difficult as the...
Yes, certainly. Absolutely right, yeah.
Now, later on, does this develop into the organisation that had a legitimate checking role? Because certainly in the 70s and 80s, the Soviets were allowed to check things going on in England and they were just allowed to come and...
Yeah, I mean, yes...
Does this later on develop?
Yeah. I said that we had two functions.
Let's do the other function.
One was to confirm what might be less accurate information being given to us. The second job was to be the eyes and ears of the West to observe for unusual movements. I mean, we were an alarm system, effectively. We patrolled frequently, every day. We covered the whole of the Soviet zone. If it wasn't the British, it was the French or the Americans. There was never a day without a patrol in all the most important areas, so that we would have spotted any unusual movement.
Which in itself was a sort of safe, because they were...
It was a safety device.
So both sides, by means of this, could see that the opposition were not... moving up or doing anything particularly unusual. Or
okay,
if they were,
yes.
Is that the case?
Yes, that's quite right. So A, you could see it if it was happening, and B, you could see that it was not happening. You're absolutely right. So it was, in a sense, a softener of relationships, perhaps. Yeah.
Were there ever any unusual? I mean, would you like to define unusual troop movements? I mean, I presume you did see some during their exercises, their exercises must have looked quite threatening. So I presume they exercised towards the border.
Of course they did, yeah, absolutely. What would happen? I mentioned permanently restricted areas and temporary. Before an exercise took place, they would send to the three missions a map outlining of temporary restricted area, showing clearly the geographical territory and B, the duration. And that was always the harbinger of a major exercise. Or, of course, it might have been an actual deployment. We might have been tricked. So the great thing was to go everywhere you could to circumvent they're retaining their movements secret. They couldn't really stop you travelling around in the Potsdam area. That's where we were entitled to be, and of course that's where a large amount of the Soviet forces were deployed. So you could see if those forces were on the move. The military trains came through in variety on a set of three different railways. They could notice unusual movements. You could patrol the autobahn in and out, backwards and forwards, watching again for traffic passing under or along the motorways. And so there were lots of ways of gaining information about what they were doing. As to specific unusual things, if you were patrolling an area where there wasn't... a restriction, you might be lucky enough, if you were in the right sort of place at the right time, to see a deployment of an unusual convoy with unusual vehicles, probably including, or maybe including, surface-to-air missiles or long-range tactical missiles. You could just possibly spot this, or special radar equipment vehicles. And the aim would be to, A, find out where they came from and where they were going to, and B, to take photographs of them. so that they could be, you know, if you've got the photograph of a radar vehicle with the radar dish down, technical experts back in UK could work out the frequency that it was likely to use, etc., etc. So it was good, useful information. So those were sort of unexpected bonuses that you could get.
Did you have in your was it a Jeep you patrolled in?
No, Opel Capitans.
Okay. would you have communication devices in there so that you could wireless straight away, or would you have to wait till you got back?
Wait till you got back. No.
Well, why not? It sounded quite a reasonable idea to have a wireless in case something happened.
Yes, we didn't. I mean, remember, I'm talking about now 1959 to 62, and then again, I went a second time, 67 to 69. But later, they did have radios, and certainly they had mobile phones and so on. Who wouldn't have? But we had no communication of that sort. The only modification we had was that we had extra petrol tanks built into our vehicles, so we could travel non-stop without filling up for a long time, as long as we could stay awake. And we had a system whereby you could switch off all brake lights, and, well, you obviously switch off tail lights and headlights, but you switch off brake lights. So that you could, because we were frequently followed by very fast BMW cars, not owned by the Russians, but owned by the East Germans. The East Germans hated Bricksmiths and Socksmiths and the American mission, the French mission, because we answered only to the Russians and not to the what they thought was a legitimate government of East Germany, the German Democratic Republic. So they hated us, and they followed us furiously in these fast BMWs. And so we could dodge them by using tracks at night, and we were better at crossing cross country and so on than they were, and they'd be bogged down and we'd wave goodbye and so on. But one of the frequent ways of dodging them was to drive along the autobahn at furious speed and then switch all the lights out and just plough off into a wood. You might get bogged down for a moment, but they would almost certainly go speeding on, hoping to see your lights again a bit later, and so then you could extricate yourself. The tricks of the trade to dodge the people that were following you so you could do your legitimate work of the mission.